All right, so we have come to our guest speaker, Lynn Weimer. Lynn Weimer is a familiar face here at Zion. She is a friend of Zion. She comes comfort and nodding with us. She's a neighbor of mine. We are partners in crime when it comes to raising butterflies, comfort and nodding, and buying batting yesterday cheap at Len's Mills.
And laughing
as well. That's right. That's right. So Lynn is a retired former nurse. She worked at Grand River Hospital in ICU, and has worked over the up north, down south in Florida over her career as well. But she's a volunteer with the Hospice Waterloo Region, and she's come today to talk to us about advanced care planning. And so I'm going to turn it over to you, Lynn, and we can go from there.
Now, my technical difficulty is that this has decided to show a bird instead of my...
Here we are. That's such a big difficulty. Birds are good, too. So thank you for inviting me to come and speak to you this morning. I am going to condense this talk down a little bit to get the important points across to you and have time to discuss afterwards. I'll go through the presentation, and afterwards I'll give you plenty of time for questions. I'll stay after. If you'd rather do a one-on-one question with me, that's totally fine too. So who we are, Hospice of Waterloo Region. We have a project that started a few years ago with funding from the local health network, and it was so successful about conversations worth having about advanced care planning that we've continued it on, and we come out and we're trying to get the public involved to understand what you need to know in advance, get physicians, nurses, all the healthcare team on the same page, legal people, so when you go to your lawyer, he'll know what you're talking about when you go in and say, this is what I told I should think about and what I should do. So one of my greatest frustrations working as a nurse, I worked 39 years as a nurse, 35 of those years in intensive care units. If a patient would come in, they're always having their worst day ever when they come to ICU. Some could still speak, express to us what they wanted. If a patient could still speak to us, we could talk to them and say, we can do this, this, and this. Is that what you want? And they could give us very clear answers on what their wishes are. We all know what our line in the sand is. I will take healthcare up to this point and won't go beyond. We all know where our own line in the sand is. But if I couldn't talk to the patient to get these consents, I would have to go to their family. So you'd go out to the waiting room of all these stressed people, and I'd ask, okay, this is what's going on with mom or dad. What do you want us to do? Do you want this, this, and this? And I'd meet these deer in the headlight eyes. What are you asking me to decide? We've never talked about this. We don't know what mom wants. And you'd have four children with four different answers. Think about your own family as I'm going through this. I'll tell you lots of stories about what I've seen at work and lots of stories about my own family. Think about your own family. First of all, family is who you say it is. The law says your family is parents, spouse, children, siblings. That's what the law will tell us, and you'll see where that comes into play. You might think somebody different is your family. Maybe your neighbor is someone that you would lean on for help if you really needed it. Maybe that's the person you would rather have making decisions for you instead of your sister or brother or parent or whoever the law says should make these decisions. So what we're talking about is advanced care planning. Heavy on the word advance and planning. Think ahead so that when you're in a crisis, you know what you would want, but more importantly, the people that will be making decisions on your behalf know what to say for you. They know the words that would have come out of your mouth if they could. Now it has to come out of their mouths. So, this, I've told you who we are. So think about this. Imagine that you're in the hospital and you're too ill or you've been injured and you cannot speak for yourself. Do you know who is going to be making those decisions on your behalf? Like I said, it would be family normally. Maybe that's not who you would want to make decisions for you. So do you know who that person would be? Flip that coin over, and this side scares me more than deciding for myself what I want. Imagine that someone near and dear to you has had a massive stroke and can't communicate anymore, or has been injured and can't communicate, and you're the one that's being called on to make decisions for that person. Now you have to come up with answers on their behalf. Do you know what healthcare they would or would not want? And quite often it gets just as important to know what they would not want. So do you know, it's very difficult to make decisions for someone else, and very difficult for me to give up that decision making to someone else. That's why we want you to think ahead and communicate ahead to people so they know what to say on your behalf. So that's what we're going to talk about, is the advanced care planning and healthcare consent. What healthcare consent is, if you go to the hospital, you need to give consent to receive any kind of medical treatment. There's one time that you do not need to give consent, and that's in a crisis. If you're in an emergency situation where your life or limb is at risk of being lost, you will receive treatment. We don't even have to know who you are. You will receive treatment, life-saving treatment, assuming that you want to live. Otherwise, if someone is there to speak for you, they must give consent before treatment can be performed upon you. Everything that we'll talk about today is Ontario laws. Healthcare is paid for by the province, therefore it's regulated by the province. Go home and Google your little brains out about all the stuff I'm going to tell you, but always when you're Googling anything, put in Ontario. When you're looking up anything about healthcare, add the words in Ontario. The laws in BC are different than Ontario. The laws in the States are totally different than in Canada. The laws in Hollywood are even way, way different. Just don't even go there. So before, as I said, before any treatment can be given to you, there must be an informed consent. And who gives that informed consent? The patient. First and foremost, if the patient can give consent, nobody else gets involved. It's the patient and only the patient who will be giving consent or refusing treatment. If the patient cannot give consent, if they are mentally incapable, there is someone called your substitute decision maker, the person that's substituting for you to make those decisions about your health care. Only when you are mentally incapable does that person step into play. What is mental incapacity? The physician and the caregivers will decide if you're mentally capable. If you're communicating still, they'll talk to you and tell you what's wrong, what treatment they can offer, what they hope that treatment will do for you, what some of the alternate treatments would be, and what the general outcome would hope to be. If they feel that you can understand that by asking appropriate questions, repeating back what you've been told, you're capable. You're mentally capable of giving consent. You may not be able to understand what's being asked of you, and then they'll turn to the substitute decision maker. Mental incapacity can be permanent, such as with dementia, unconscious, that you've had a massive stroke, will not recover consciousness, or it can be temporary. I've had surgery, I'm on a whole bunch of narcotics, I'm a little bit loopy from them. The doctor comes and says, I just need to do a little bit more surgery here. He needs a consent to take me back to the operating room, but I'm seeing butterflies that aren't really there and and not able to give a proper consent. Then someone would have to step in and make decisions on my behalf. Tomorrow, I'm settled down, or the narcotics are back into place, so that my brain has come back inside my head, and I'm back in the driver's seat again. I can make decisions from then on. So that would be a temporary mental incapacity. And as I said, the only exception when you do not need to give a consent is in the case of a dire emergency. So what's advanced care planning in Ontario? The first thing is to know who will be making these decisions if you cannot make these decisions for yourself. Who is your future substitute decision maker? And the second one, talk to that person. Don't just say, yep, this is my substitute decision maker, and just, I'm not going to tell you anything. No, I'm just appointing you, and you're going to be the one. I had an elderly, reclusive gentleman, single. He admitted, of course, late at night, because they're always late at night. He came in. We knew he was going to get much worse before he would get better. And so we could go through with him. This is what's wrong. This is the treatment we'll offer. What will you accept? He answered he was very with it. He could answer clearly, these are the treatments I'll accept. These are the treatments I will not accept. This is for how long I will accept these treatments. Great. So I said, do you have a power of attorney, or do you know who your substitute decision maker would be? Yes, he was so proud. I went to the lawyer, I appointed a power of attorney for my personal care. It's my nephew, here's his phone number, here's his name, he lives 2 hours away, good to go. I called his nephew and said, your Uncle Bob has been admitted to the hospital, this is what's going on. And I get dead silence. And I thought, oh, I called the wrong person late at night. So he said, who are you talking about? And I said, well, he said he's your Uncle Bob and this is who he is. And he said, you're his nephew. He said, I haven't heard of that man for 30 years. Yes, I'm his nephew, he's a recluse. He's pulled away from the family. I know nothing about him as an adult. Since I've become an adult, I haven't seen him since I was a little child. I know nothing about him. He was appointed legally, this man's power of attorney, but Uncle Bob didn't bother to share that with his nephew. Don't do that. Make sure you talk to that person before you expect them to make decisions for you. How do you identify your substitute decision maker? There's two ways to identify who it will be in Ontario. The one I strongly, strongly, strongly encourage is to complete a legal power of attorney for personal care. There's all kinds of handout information over there, you're welcome to. There's two types of power of attorney in Ontario, well, anywhere, but the one we're talking about today is power of attorney for personal care. Anything to do with my person, my well-being, my health, my physical care. The other one is power of attorney for property. They can pay your hydro bill, they can do your taxes, they can sell your house, your car. Both are pretty important and very important to think about who you want to appoint to be that person. But the only one we're talking about today is the power of attorney for personal care. And as I go through, you'll see why I encourage so much that you do this. The other one, we all have somebody who will automatically be appointed our substitute decision maker. The government says who it will be. As I said, the government dictates who your family is. That may not be who you want
I'll
to make decisions.
I'll probably get Doug Ford.
Chris. God bless you all. So he's not related though, so you won't
get
him.
I don't want him.
No, you won't get him. So you would confirm the person who's on that hierarchy. Now here's the hierarchy. This goes from top to bottom. If you come to the hospital and you're needing a decision made on your behalf, the healthcare team will look at this list and they'll start at the top and keep working their way down till they find the first person. As soon as they find a person, they stop looking. That's who makes your decisions from then on. The first three are all legally appointed people. The first one is a court-appointed guardian. You'll know if that's you because you've been a few hours in a lawyer's office getting documents set up. This is, say, an adult with, say, Down syndrome, someone who can't make decisions, look after themselves. They need, when they're a child, mom and dad look after them. As they become an adult, somebody has to. So someone is appointed to look after this person. Someone who has the ability to care for themselves and make their own decisions. A court may appoint someone to look after that person as their guardian. The next one is what we're talking about today, the attorney for personal care. When we say attorney, we don't mean a lawyer. We mean the person, an attorney is someone who speaks for you. So that's who this is, the attorney that you have selected to speak for you. I like this one because it tells me that you thought about it. You sat there and you thought, no, Doug Ford isn't who I want to make decisions for me. My brother isn't the person I want to make decisions. My husband isn't the one I want to make decisions. I want you to make decisions because I think you'll do the best job. So you've appointed that person legally, and that's the only person that will make decisions from then on. The next one is a representative appointed by consent and capacity. This is an uncommon one, but say I have a neighbor and the wife goes to the hospital and the husband is the one that's making decisions for her, but I know that this husband has been abusing this wife for years and years and he doesn't make good decisions. I can go to the courts and say, here's what's going on in the house. I think someone else should be appointed. And then the courts would go through and appoint someone else. It may not be the person of your choosing though. So that, again, pick the person you want. Then we get to spouse or partner. That should be an easy one. There should only be one on that line. A spouse or partner is same sex, opposite sex, legally married or common law, or someone that, say two people live together for years and years and years as roommates, not a romantic relationship, but they've lived together and consider themselves family. That could be your partner. As I said, you'd think there'd only be one on that line. Not always. I did have a patient one time who lived in one city with his legal wife, worked in another city all week long, so lived there all week long, but not alone. So he gets in an accident. As it happened, his common-law wife was with him, so she comes, she tells us, she's his common-law wife, she's sitting there, loving him, being attentive, lovely lady. A couple of days later, I get a phone call, or we're at work, get a phone call. Hi, I'm Mrs. Smith. I understand my husband's been there for the last 2 days. And I'm thinking, okay, you're Mrs. Smith.
Who is this?
So, who's making decisions now? Common-law wife, legal wife?
None of them. Should
both of them. Yeah. How well do you think those two are going to work together? Both would make decisions equally for that person. Now, supposing you're separated or divorced. This spouse isn't really your spouse anymore. Is that person still making decisions for you? No. If you're separated or divorced, that is no longer your spouse. They don't make decisions for you. Unless you appointed them power of attorney for personal care, then they are still making decisions for you. So if you go through any marriage breakdown, you need to review a whole lot more than just the marriage contract. So if you don't have a spouse or partner, you get down to, it should say parents and children, because everybody on this line is treated equally. So sandwich generation, your parents and your children have to work together. How old do you have to be to make decisions for someone's health care, do you think?
18?
16.
Oh my
gosh. Babies. They're babies making decisions. Again, I had another patient who was single, she was divorced, had siblings, had three children. The oldest was 17, the others were younger. She had cancer, was dying. Decisions had to be made, unfortunately, to remove life support from this lady. Who made those decisions? 17-year-old daughter. That's a baby making a decision about a very grown-up thing. So had she had parents, the parents would have been involved in that as well. How many grandparents really think their teenage grandchildren know anything? How well do you think they're going to work together? Mm-hmm. Not very well. Of course, they're not going to, the grandparents aren't going to want to dump that on their grandchildren. If there's children's aid is involved and one parent has only right of access, visitation rights, and the other parent isn't around, then the next one would be that parent with right of access. Then you get down, if you've got none of these, you get down to siblings, all your siblings. All together. As we grow older, I mean, when you're young, you have your fights with your siblings, but you're there, you know each other well. As we grow older, you marry, you move away, you've got different families' inputs, things change among your siblings. It's hard to get together and to all be on the same page about a decision. If there's none of those, you go to any other relative, aunts, uncles, cousins, in-laws. Anybody that can possibly be pulled out of the woodwork that's got the same DNA as you do. If there is absolutely nobody, it goes down to the public guardian and trustee. It's a person appointed to make a decision, and then it might be Doug Ford doing it for you. There is a person who knows nothing about you that is appointed to make a decision on your behalf. So, pardon me, I'll tell you my family to show you how this would work with a person. I'm married, I don't have children. I have, my father is alive, well, totally mentally stable. He'll be 96 next month. I have three siblings, live all over Ontario. I'm one of 18 cousins. I have 14 nieces and nephews, great nieces and nephews. Many of them are over 16, so they're considered adults. So like they'd be, if you get to any other relative, I'd have about 40 people that they would have to call on. So here's the scenario. My husband and I, oh, and by the way, I have appointed my husband as my legal power of attorney for personal care. My husband and I are in a car accident. We're both unconscious and need decisions made. Who's making them? I don't have a court-appointed guardian. I have a power of attorney. Husband, unconscious, on the next stretcher. Not helping. Don't have a representative. I have a spouse. Husband, unconscious, not helping. Parents and children, I don't have children, I have a father. Right of access, no. Three siblings, and then 50 other relatives. Who's making decisions for me?
Your father.
95-year-old father. Is that what I want? No. But I did everything right. I appointed a power of attorney. Mm-hmm. It failed me. So what do? You appoint an alternate. And remember, that alternate is someone close to you. What if he's in the car too? And he's also in there. Like, I like to create things to worry about. Appoint a second alternate.
Be a writer.
Yeah, the big mystery novels. So appoint a second alternate. Who do you appoint? We have an expression, appoint a person, not a committee. So you've got, in this region, you could have 10 children easily, and I've dealt with that. When you look at, as I said, to give an informed consent, if we're getting into the part of the children, I could be out there talking to 10 children in the waiting room to get a consent of what to do for mom. So I have to give every one of them the information they need to make that decision. There's 10 of them. If I'm lucky, you five will all be here at one time. I can talk to you all at once. It's going to take at least 15 minutes to go through that and give you time to ask questions, make sure you understand. You were at work. I call you from work, go through the whole thing again, 15 minutes. You were away on vacation. I get a hold of you finally later in the day, again, 15 minutes to go through everything. You two show up later in the day, go through the whole thing all over again. I'll go through it as many times as you want as the nurse, but 15 minutes, 15 minutes, 15 minutes, 15 minutes. Who's looking after mom? I'd like to be looking after her instead of spending an hour and a half, potentially, and an hour and a half is common to spend talking to family to get consent. If I could have had just one of you, or at most two of you, come together, make a decision on behalf of everybody else, and use all their input, go to them to get suggestions and advice and guidance, but one or two at the most to be the actual spokesperson. So you're going to say, but I've got three kids. If I only appoint one of them, the other two are going to be offended.
You won't.
They don't want to do it. Honestly, it makes so much more sense. It speeds the process. Things get done. You know what it's like working as a committee. How hard is it to get a decision made? Your three or four kids, how did they do planning Christmas dinner? Did they all come on the same page and coordinate that everybody could get together at one time, or did it create a big rift? You don't want to impose that on your family. The fewer the better as far as doing any kind of planning and decision making.